ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Looking at your finances more closely this tax time? On the ABC Business Daily podcast, we break down the stories shaping employment and the economy. And as the financial year comes to a close, we're breaking down what you need to know about super, write-offs, property, and shares in a special tax series. Hear it now. Search ABC Business Daily on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party: change or die.
The public are sick and tired of being ignored.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from Ngunnawal Country in Parliament House in Canberra.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation here in Sydney.
Now, Fran, I'm very excited that we've got back together, the band back together. What am I? The bassist or something probably. But we are together answering people's questions. How good are people's questions, can I say? Like, since we've been doing these special episodes, it is a tsunami of questions coming our way. It is full on, seriously.
Top notch our listeners, top notch our listeners' questions. In fact, you know, some of them are so good we have been proven to be really unable to answer them sufficiently. And that's why we've got help from an expert this week, PK. Someone you all know and love will be answering one of your questions. But before we get to that, PK, I did see some sad news last week. I forgot to check in with you, so consider this a welfare check. Ponies hasn't been renewed for a second season.
Yeah, that's a bit sad, isn't it? That's tragic.
I hate that when that happens.
Oh, I know, and it's like you get attached and then you've got to go through a mourning period. Oh, I know. Look, I'm still knee-deep, I've got
to
say.
Honestly, I don't know who makes these decisions sometimes.
Well,
seriously.
People that clearly want to make money, and it clearly wasn't making enough money, I'm assuming, but that is on people who haven't been choosing it, clearly. I'm more still obsessed with the West Wing halfway through now, so that's my thing. But the other thing, of course, we've all been obsessed with is the World Cup and, you know, as the joke goes, how are those male Matildas going? Well, they're doing pretty well, Fran, okay?
I've not heard the male Matildas. Yeah. That's hilarious.
I love that. The Matildas.
No, they're doing pretty well. They've made it through to the knockout round. I don't know about you, but I am going to be getting up. How are you still going, getting up at 4 a.m. after all those years on breakfast? You still up for it?
Oh, I'm up for
Easy?
It. I'm up for it. My body still does it.
I'm going to be up tuning in at 4 a.m. And who's your favourite socceroo?
Oh, that's such a good question.
I've got one.
Okay, go.
My favourite is Christian Volpato, who's the young guy, I think he's 22 or something, and we brought him over from Italy. There was a question mark whether he'd make the Italian team. He's been living and training over there for a long time. But he is just really out of the box. He's great and creating lots of really flashy runs. He plays, you know, high level in Italy, so he's really used to this sort of high-grade
I don't want to be too on brand for myself because I'm now a caricature of myself. But my favourite soccer player is Ellie Carpenter, and I know the Matildas are not in this World Cup.
They're not
the
in
male World Cup,
with the program.
Sometimes I just want to talk about Ellie Carpenter, which is a
little, she's my favourite too. Did you know that?
Oh, it says a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, it
what
says
is
a
it?
Lot.
It's the way she struts, isn't it?
It's just everything about her. She is a fighter. She's a real fighter.
Why? Why is she so good?
PK, we have no time for this. We'll have to take this offline. I think it's time we head into question time, shall we?
Let's do it.
We shall move to questions without notice. Are there any questions? I give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Yeah.
Prime Minister.
The bells are ringing. That means it's time for our question time. This week, our first question comes from Ryan.
Hi, friend of PK. My question's this. Why is it that so few people seem to understand that the only ones benefiting from increasing house prices are investors? People who only want to own their own home to live in might well feel wealthier when prices go up, but there's no real gain because the next home that they move to is also going to be more expensive, as is the stamp duty. Similarly, when there's a downturn in prices, they might earn less on the sale of their house, but the next house is also going to be cheaper. Why are people so irrational, and what does this mean for the government's housing reforms? Love the pod. Thanks.
That is a great question, Ryan. Yes. Okay. This is genuinely the most wicked of all questions. Yes, there is a contradiction in the kind of politics, but I think it makes sense. But just to go to your point, yeah, people were, I mean, I spoke to somebody in the government who said, you know, just 12 months ago, we were getting hammered for why are prices of housing so high? What are you going to do about it? How are young people ever going to get into the market? Like, it was the biggest crisis of the nation, right? They seek to resolve that, and you can have your own judgments and fair enough about how, but they seek to resolve that. And now the sky is falling. Like, it's like everyone's losing their minds that perhaps the housing market is crashing, and it's not quite crashing yet, but that it's going down. It is very much a contradiction, I think. Yes, you're right. You do sell in the same market. I suppose it's a bit more complex, though, than just that. People's emotions, when it's linked to their own well-being, sometimes are pretty high. I think you have to expect that with the good comes the bad. That's the thing about reform, isn't it, Fran? You can't do something that where everyone's like, yay, we're winners. Like, there's often a downside. So are people being irrational? Well, I suppose if it's your only asset, you're not being irrational to be upset about this. But this is the complexity.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on your head there. I think there's a couple of things going on regarding your house as your only asset. I think this is an issue that's really developed in Australia over the last 30 so years, that our houses have become not so much our place of shelter, but they've become our asset. And we all think of them in those terms. So we feel rich when our house prices go up, and we feel less rich when they go down. And no one likes feeling less rich. And that also has a psychological impact too on how we spend. And so that has an impact and flow on through to the market. So there's that. But there's also the notion, the issue that we have been in a housing boom. Prices have gone, I mean, they've skyrocketed. Look at what's happening in not just the major cities, but look what's happening in Adelaide, in Perth, in Brisbane. The house prices are sky high. And so people think this is the norm. It's not the norm. I remember years ago when I bought my house, you know, we were soon after it dipped, and it stayed down for a good 5 years or so. But then it lifted again. And so all that went down came back and more. That is almost certainly what will happen again at some point in the housing market. But right now, especially for those people who've just taken a loan, and so they've just got a big mortgage and they've got it because they were desperate to get into the housing market. They may have got up when the house prices were high. They are going to dip. We are seeing that. And, you know, Treasury says that they'll still grow, but they'll grow more slowly. I think, you know, Ryan's point is right. No point freaking out. You bought a house to live in. You're going to be living in it, so it doesn't really matter. And if you are going to move, then you'll be buying in the same market. So theoretically, you're not going to be worse off here. But I think it has made a real psychological impact, and that is causing the government some real problems right now politically.
Yes, I think that's right. But they're saying we're going to stay the course. We will turn around. I've been told by, you know, government, senior government people, we believe that house prices will rebound, the point you're making, Fran. We'll see whether that's right. They do really believe in the forecasts. They say it will rebound and they will get long-term credit, particularly from young people, but others that are concerned that, you know, that they did something to kind of try and deal with this generational problem we faced. Our next question comes from Lauren.
Hi, PK and Fran. Love your show. Love politics. Love poll analysis. My question is, I've never seen any data that tells us after an election how many people followed the how to vote card and the preferences versus how many people just choose their own adventure. Do you guys know what happens with this information? Because all this conversation about preference deals seems irrelevant to me if we knew how many people actually didn't follow the instructions.
Lauren, okay. We thought we would ask someone much more across this. I mean, I could have done that thing where I just talk a bit of palaver for you, but why would I do that?
In other words, we could have made something up, yeah, Lauren.
Yeah. Why don't we let Anthony Green actually give you an accurate answer?
Well, it's a very good question, Lauren, and I've got the answer for you. It's very difficult to get information on whether people follow a how-to-vote card because, you know, the ballot papers are all on bits of paper. There are, in New South Wales, they data enter the ballot papers for the lower house. There's a couple of seats in the Victorian election last time where they data entered the ballot papers. So what we have actually is mainly, there's two types of data, which is the traditional data, which is preference flow data. For all the people who voted for this party, where did their preference end up and was it the same place that the party's how to vote ended up? The other type of data is where you've got access to that ballot paper data. Now, another thing to say also is that with how to votes, the overwhelming majority of how to votes are handed out to get a first preference. Most of them are Labour, Liberal, the larger parties. It's those how to votes you see more of. It's about getting a first preference vote, and it's about getting people to fill in the rest of the ballot paper for a formal vote. So to some extent, how to votes are largely about first preferences, but they, for particularly parties are going to get excluded, they try to influence the how to votes. What we know is that if, the say, the Greens hand out a how to vote card which recommends preferences for Labour, 80 to 85% of them will follow that. Slightly lower if they recommend preferences to anywhere else, but that's unusual. But the limited amount of data which has got, where we got that, what numbers were filled in, we know that about 40% of people copy the how to vote card for the major parties. For the minor parties, it gets smaller and smaller. The Greens voters are about 20 to 30%, might be exactly the number of numbers on the ballot on the how to vote. But they end up at the same destination. They sort of start at the same point with the Green candidate and then they make up their own route to get to the final destination. So I think that's, they're the two types of data you see. Clearly, how to votes have an interest. If you don't hand out a how to vote card, people make up all their own preferences. But in the case of people like the Greens, their voters are committed to the Green cause, the cause of the left. And even if you don't see a how to vote card, they tend to put preferences to Labour. Even in cases where they put an independent second before Labour, you find that half of the votes will still go to Labour. There's also the question, we don't really know how people fill in votes. Do they follow the how to vote card by just numbering the numbers out of order down the ballot paper, or do they try to follow the sequence? What it does seem to indicate is they try to follow the sequence. So people, the second preference is important, the third, the fourth, the fifth, less important. And you find that a preference, if for a particular party, the preferences go very directly to the most likely. So from the right, they would go to the Liberals, from the left, they would go to Labour. So that tends to happen very quickly, a second or third preference. If you remember the last federal election, the Liberal Party negotiated with One Nation to change what they were going to issue as the how to vote card. So the Liberal were listed second, not fourth. So it tells you that there is a knowledge that what you do with that second and third preference is more important than the seventh and eighth. When it gets to the bottom of the ballot paper, people are just sort of filling in the rest of the numbers.
How good is Anthony Green? We all love Anthony. I know you love him too. And how interesting is that? So, you know, it's going to feed in to all our thoughts and all this talk about preference deals. Okay, our next question comes from Matt.
Hi, Patricia and the team. Really love your show. Guys, there's been a lot of talk about Pauline Hanson becoming the next Prime Minister, but for that she needs a lower house seat. Which seat do you think she would run for?
Great question. Okay, does she need to run for a lower house seat? Well, the convention is yes, that the Prime Minister comes from the lower house. However, it's not unprecedented to have a senator as Prime Minister, and so it is possible. There's nothing written in the Constitution, Fran, is there, that says, but no. It's convention, which is important.
It's what PK says. It's what we call convention. John Gorton was elected as leader in the Senate after Harold Holt disappeared, but he very quickly stood for a by-election to move into the lower house. So I think it's unreasonable and illogical to think that if Pauline Hanson is still right, if One Nation's still running high in the polls, Pauline Hanson won't likely contest a lower house seat, because if she really does have ambition to be Prime Minister, which she said she's ready for, then she'll have to be doing that. But it is a big throw of the dice. If she does do that, PK, where is she going to go? Pauline Hanson did once hold the seat of Oxley in Queensland. That was redistributed, lost its real stronghold and most of Ipswich before the 98 election. That seat is now held by the Speaker of the House, Labor MP Milton Dick. So where would she run, PK? That's the question.
Look, there's a few options in Queensland, but the truth is I could give you all the kind of speculation. You can just Google that, though. I'm not going to, because I'm not. She has not told me what seat she wants to run for. I can exclusively reveal. However, I think it's fair to say that Pauline Hanson is a sort of, you know, extremely well-recognised figure. Yes, she has some negatives, of course, but she's also got quite a lot of popularity at the moment. So if she was to run against a sitting national MP in a number of those seats in Queensland, wherever she wanted to, I think she would give them a run for their money. I think they know that. So it's really up to her. I'm not saying it's all, you know, done and dusted, but don't you agree, Fran? Like, I think.
I do. I think that she would hold a strong advantage. And funnily enough, there is the seat of right, which is outer urban, rural, scenic rim seat getting down towards the Gold Coast, which is, you know, an area that Pauline Hanson is very, very well connected with. And that is owned by the LNP and Scott Buckholz, so that would be the sort of seat perhaps she'd look at, though she has indicated in the past that if she did, it would be a Labor seat, I think. Now, I don't know if she's just trying to, you know, stir up Labor there. So someone suggested the seat of Lilly to her, which is where Annika Wells, the Labor minister, is the member, and she sort of scoffed at that. That's not the sort of seat she'd go for. It's a city seat. She's more likely to go for a seat like Dixon, out of Brisbane, held by Ali France. She of course, won it from Peter Dutton. That's the sort of seat. But, look, we don't know. We're all just guessing. It'll be, if she does it, it'll depend on where the polls are, and she'll have a throw of the dice, and she'll do it where all their internal polling suggests she's got the best chance. But one thing we can tell you, it will be in Queensland.
Yep, I think that's right. Okay, our next question comes from Sarah, and it's written, so let me read it. Hello, PK and Fran. I am wondering if the interest in One Nation is more about disruption than populism. Do young people want to disrupt the current political environment rather than actually holding the long-held racism and other far-right beliefs of Pauline Hanson? If a young, savvy, interesting leader mobilised a sincere model for generational change and established sound economic reform policies that made sense, wouldn't that overtake the rise of One Nation? The mayor of New York, Mondani, is a perfect example of this sort of generational change. And now with the rise of Andy Burnham in the UK, there is another path to renewal of leadership. Is a change of leadership to Mark Butler enough? I don't think so, but I am hoping. What do you think? 10-year listener, love the pod. Sarah from the Bega Valley, which I love in New South Wales. Oh, I want to be there, but I'm not. Fran, is it about disruption? Well, it is about disruption, sure.
Yes, it is clearly about disruption. And that's I think your question is right, that do young people want to disrupt the political environment rather than actually hold the long-held racism and other far-right beliefs of Pauline Hanson? Answer to those things is yes, they do want to disrupt. And no, they don't generally hold those beliefs, particularly around energy and renewable energy. But that's why, on the one hand, we're seeing One Nation trying to sort of develop themselves a bit to be a bit more than just the issues that have been their sort of their badge issues so far. That's on the one hand. On the other part of your question, if a young, savvy, interesting leader mobilised a sincere model for generational change with economic reform, well, that's all very well, but who is that and where would they be? Would they be coming up through the Labor Party, the government as it is? Would they be coming up through the coalition? I don't think Mark Butler, if that's what you're suggesting, within the Labor Party necessarily counts or fits the description of young, savvy, interesting leader. I don't think that's fits there necessarily. And I don't think he's necessarily seen as any kind of front runner within Labor. PK, maybe I'm wrong there.
Oh,
you think?
Well, the reason that this is even being asked is he is being seen as a front runner is a bit of a stretch.
I reckon.
Certainly being promoted, you know, internally by people. Like
he's very close to the Prime Minister, right? So yes, that's something. But it's not really what we're seeing in terms of generational change, I don't think. I mean, if you were really talking generational change, wouldn't you be looking at Jim Chalmers or maybe even, I don't know, Katie Gallagher?
Katie Gallagher's in the Senate, but yeah, she'd have to, you know, be a bit complicated. But yes, look, if you look at the sort of last public poll actually on leadership that was published just yesterday by Sky, It showed that the second is Jim Chalmers in terms of who people expect to be the leader of the Labor Party, perhaps next, and then they are, next after that is Tanya Plibersek. Yeah, I mean, I think the to the your like core question though about, you know, are people motivated? What are they motivated by? If you look at the last poll, I think the Greens vote ticked up a bit.
It did.
And that's interesting, right? That's maybe if you make your Mundani point, like that bit of the left-wing disruption maybe happening a bit too, which I'm sure Larissa Waters, the Greens leader, would have been relieved by because they weren't getting much of that dividend. So, yeah, I've always believed and always argued and always based this on a lot of reading and of the deeper weeds of the research that the FON, the One Nation support is not coming from sort of this knee-jerk racism, as people are saying. It's not. It's economic grievance and frustration. And I think that's bearing fruit. Like, I think that's obvious. I don't think we're about to see new leadership, though, at the federal level for the Labor Party. I think there is a sense of stability inside the government, from my observation. Doesn't mean people aren't kind of positioning and trying, you know, to give it a red-hot go to try and make sure that, you know, perhaps they're seen as
they're an alternative. They're in the box seat for the next time.
Yeah, but I don't see those things bubbling up yet.
On the other side of politics, however, there is some of that going on, certainly some of that talk going on and some of that jostling going on. And Andrew Hastie probably does fit the image of young, savvy, younger anyway, savvy, more interesting leader, I would think, if you're interested in that side of politics. So anyway, I think it's all a bit early for this kind of talk. I don't think we don't have the capacity, I don't think, for another leader to come up without a party and start a new party and try and emerge there like that. So I don't think we're going to be seeing a Mundani, but I think, you know, your point is right. As PK said, it is all about, at the moment, the disruption. People are flexing their muscles and showing we're not happy, we're disenchanted with this party system, it hasn't worked for us, and you better do something about it.
Yep. And they're making their views loud and clear. Our next question comes from Jude.
And Jude has written a question because, as they say, I'm not doing a voice note because I'm a bit shy. I'm a daily listener and constant fan. So good on you, Jude. Your question is valued. Angus Taylor seems to be almost the invisible man. He's rarely seen or heard on any ABC program. Is he avoiding mainstream media and favouring the more right-wing options? This smacks of the same policy followed by Peter Dutton that in the end worked against him because he wasn't stretching himself under robust questioning. Or am I missing something? PK, what do you think?
I can answer that.
Go.
Yeah, I think he is avoiding scrutiny, actually. I mean, I know because we ask him all the time to come on Afternoon Briefing. All his colleagues come on. Andrew Hastie is a regular on our show. You know, if you'd heard some of the sort of things written about them all, apparently he's the more right-wing figure out of the two, yet, you know, he's happy to front up to the free-to-air ABC audience and talk to me. So I think that is the answer. I mean, that is like evidence. I don't think he fronts up a lot. I'm not saying he never fronts up because that's not true either. So he has appeared on AM and, you know, like I do think that Angus Taylor has said yes to some requests. So you wouldn't say it's like some sort of boycott. But I don't think he's subjecting himself to enough airtime. And I say that as a journalist who believes people should subject themselves to lots of journalists and be part of, you know, not vacate the field. Yeah, I think the way he's communicating is a big problem for him.
Yeah, and I think the question is why. I would say that in the last week or so, I think he has emerged a bit. He is doing a bit more publicly. He's saying a bit more publicly, and that's under pressure from within, I think. I think the point is he's not ready to be pressure tested. He's on this process in his mind of, you know, this is, we've got to get our policies, our ducks in the row, got to get our policies sorted. We'll talk when, you know, I'll talk when I've got something to talk about. So he's trying to maintain it on his terms. But that's not how politics works if you're the leader. And I feel like his emergence this week on a few more fronts is probably indirect pressure from within his party room, to say, okay, get out and start talking us up, start defending us, start talking our book. Yes, we've got to get policies. That's true. That work is going on. And PK, you spoke to Andrew Hastie this week, and he was very clear about that and with a timeline and everything. But the leader doesn't have the luxury of just talking when they want to talk. They've got to respond to big moments, and there's been a few of those coming thick and fast in the last few weeks.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think when you're on 17% in the news poll, you don't have the right or the luxury to be being so selective. Like you
no,
are.
That's right. You've got to be everywhere.
You know, I just find it astonishing. It's like yeah. I wouldn't be taking a no-risk policy. I would be taking every risk. And I thought there was evidence of risk with the announcement of the indexation policy at the in his budget reply. So that
but you've got to back yourself.
You've got to go out and talk and talk and talk.
And when he has been pressure tested around multiculturalism, he didn't go well, right? So that's hardly going to fill him with confidence to step up again. But you're right. You're absolutely right.
Our next question comes from Josh.
Hi, Party Room. Josh here from NAM. I know the world is heating up, the far right is surging, and I won't be able to buy a house anytime soon, but I would like to ask a question today about something we haven't really spoken too much in the public domain about, possibly what I think is the most undervalued yet most impactful industry in the country, the arts industry. Recently, it was announced Beetlejuice the Musical would be cancelling its Australian run 7 months early, devastating the Australian live performance industry and joining a growing list of productions over the past few years that have closed early or cancelled tours. In the film and TV sector, our cultural output is declining with less local content being made, production houses forced to compete with big US projects, and now the ABC and SBS are under attack from One Nation on top of the usual political pressuring they go through. Do you think there's reason to be concerned about the state of the arts in Australia? And what have our politicians said, if anything, about this? I'd personally love a refund on my HECS debt, considering I started my degree the year the government upped the price of arts degrees, but that's just my opinion. Thanks so much for your time, and I'm keen to hear your response.
I'm going first just on the arts degree. I'm obsessed with this, and I have to declare a bias, okay? I have to because I think you don't need to watch your biases. I have a child who's a year away from going to university. Now, I never thought that would happen, but it's about to happen. She is basically a product of me, so she's a humanities girl. And I just cannot believe that her arts degree is going, now that I'm actually, you know, facing that, going to cost more than a STEM degree just because they're her skills and passions. I think that is.
And a lot more, right?
A lot more. It does my head in. And it's this and so the job's ready program, which is the Morrison government's upping of the arts degrees versus the STEM degrees, and that's a crude way of saying it, Labor has promised to do something about it. However, I spoke to Jason Clare just this week, who is the education minister. He said he won't even get the report till end of next year, and then they'll consider doing something about it.
It's too slow. It's too slow. They promised this. You know, they talked it up. They were critical. Don't you reckon? They're just too slow on this.
This one I declared openly, clearly an agenda here from me because my actual child is about to face this and I'm not into it. I'm upset about it. I'm really upset about it. And I know lots of people are. Anyway, can you take the rest of the question? Because I just needed to get that off my chest.
Yeah. And I'm with you. And when I say it's too slow, because I think it's counterproductive. You know, there was some report yesterday telling universities that their graduates aren't ready for the current, you know, the modern workplace, and that they're coming out. Yes, they can know how to use AI and they've used that all through their uni degree, but they're not coming out with the communication skills, the emotional intelligence, the resilience, the critical thinking skills that they need in this world of technology, of modern technology in the modern world. And guess what? Some of those are the skills you get from a humanities degree. So I think this is all cockeyed and the government really should be a little more focused on this, a lot more really, because the HECS issue too is a very, very big one, fairly so for younger Australians. But in terms of what's going on in the arts, is it undervalued? Yes, I think it is. This has been a slow decline. We do have an arts minister in Tony Burke who is very committed to the arts, but generally as a policy area, it's not seen as a priority. I don't think most Australians see it as a priority. Funding hasn't been particularly innovative or it hasn't been front of mind in election campaign. Arts policy launches used to be huge. Now they barely rate a mention. Yes, we've seen those musicals not working. This is post-COVID. Theatre attendances are still not back up. The theatre companies got heavily hit during COVID. They need more support. They really do. We can't afford to be a nation. We don't want to be a nation that doesn't have a vibrant, you know, theatre life, do we? We don't want to be a nation that doesn't write our own plays because playwrights can't make a living and therefore our stories aren't being told. Now, the three musicals you're talking of, Beetlejuice, Waitress and Aida, they're not Australian stories, but they are a sign of an industry that needs support. And, you know, that's the sort of musical where they're popular. You know, a lot of Australians go to them. And it's part of inculcating in the population this notion of we love going to the arts, we like going to the theatre. It's not just about film. It is too about film. It's not just about our authors. It is too about that in the age of AI. And PK, I think, you know, you were dealing with this. There's been a whole trail of artists through Parliament House this week, and you've been dealing directly with it.
Yeah, the artists are really concerned about AI. They're really worried that some sort of dodgy deal is happening behind the scenes between, you know, big AI and the government over copyright and their ability to mine, you know, content for this. But you know what? Government keeps saying we're not going to water down copyright. The artists are paranoid because why is the reporting that there's, you know, some discussions about it? So I think they're being really smart and strategic actually in getting ahead of it, despite the government guarantees to say, hey, you know, we are going to make a very big deal. So many of them coming to Parliament, including Paul Dempsey, who I interviewed from Something for Kate, you know, one of my favourite bands of, well, yes, as I'm ageing now, it's not a new band.
Of your time.
Not a new band. Anyway, watch that space, though, because they are getting very active and I can understand why. And, you know, like, I don't mean to sort of be too much of a bleeding heart, but come on. Like, without Australian stories, we're nothing. Like, that is our national identity. We're in an era, by the way, if I can just make this point, where the sort of traditional, I think the arts are seen as a lefty thing, which I think is silly because I think arts are sort of performed by everyone. But it's seen that way. There is nothing more nationalistic in terms of the politics in some ways than wanting to hear your own stories, wanting your own arts. Like, there is actually, if we're talking about national identity and all of the things that have become culture issues of our time, what is more important than having your national identity protected than these issues, Fran?
Like, well, I think, you know, that's exactly right. And that's been a Labor story for such a long time. And as I say, the current minister is very much into that story. But they got to put their money where their mouth is. I think it'll be interesting to see what the government is planning to do on copyright, because there's also an enormous push from the government and they're extolling this at every opportunity. How great the investment coming in from data centres, which is all about supporting AI. It's so important to the economic model, to the government's Made in Australia pitch. They're sort of building some kind of economic portfolios, policies around this investment around data centres. So they need that to happen. But at the same time, the copyright issue is a big one. I think despite the government's language that they say they're going to protect the arts, stand up for artists and protect them, I think there might be some movement here, and it'll be about funding, making the data centre investors put in more funds so that the artists can get due payment and stuff, and, you know, just payment. So I think there'll be something there, but we will wait and see.
That's it for the Party Room today. Keep sending your questions in because they're excellent and they certainly make my brain, you know, they say you need brain teasers and stuff to avert any later problems. Well, I can promise you that's what your questions do. Send them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
Yeah, I absolutely love these Question Time episodes, so thank you. David Spears is going to be back for Insiders on Background on Saturday. And PK, you're off for a little while. Mel is going to be in the hot seat with Politics Now from Monday.
Yeah, I'll be back Wednesday. It's a very mini break and there's no snow and everyone's heard me whinge about that.
There's
but anyway,
no snow. I saw the
but
images.
But we're going to Mount Buller, so we'll be looking at the trees. Hello, trees. And I'll be watching the Socceroos. Because I won't be able to ski. It's perfect. Go to the Socceroos. See you, Fran.
See you, PK.